Good morning. We have a number of students with us this morning. My notes tell me that Xavier High School from Appleton students are here. Would they please stand with their advisor? Very good. Very good. Thank you. Please be seated. The students are here with a program that this court runs in combination with the state bar called Court with Class. So they've had the opportunity to see some of the information that is going to be presented here today by way of briefs. And if they can remain after the second argument over the lunch hour, Justice Ian Walsh Bradley will come out and chat with the students, not about the merits of the case, but really about how the Supreme Court operates and whatever pearls she'd like to give to you all and questions that she, I'm sure, would be willing to answer. Now, we have seen you. I'd like to introduce the court to all of you who are present. On my far right is Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to Justice Ziegler, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and she is the justice who will be speaking with you at noon. On her left, Justice Michael Gableman, and beyond Justice Gableman, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those remarks, our case that is up is the estate of Stanley Miller versus Story. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes.
Please do.
Chief Justice and other members of the court, good morning. Thank you for, on behalf of my client, thank you for taking the time and to hear the case that's before you today. While you may have a lot of questions about this case, it really serves as a textbook case on damages. It takes me back to our law school days where we studied damages and the effects of the damages and how they're going to be extrapolated from the result of a trial. The reason this case is on appeal is because we're dealing with a statute for it has a variety of purposes, one of which is to allow private parties to address wrongs. In this particular case, it was an instance of elder abuse. It was a case where a caretaker stole from her relative, and through the course of a probate proceeding, my client, who is the sister of the decedent, was contacted by a local banker. It's a small town, and he noticed some suspicious activity occurring with this person's account, and because of that, he told the sister, my client, who's the personal representative, that she should look into it. And so that's the initial framework of 895.446. It allows private parties to investigate wrongs. Now, we're generally used to civil cases where we have various forms of discovery, and that was done here. And despite the fact that this was a small claims trial, there was discovery conducted. But at the outset of this case, once the personal representative determined there was some cause to proceed forward, tandem to an officer of the law seeking probable cause, she proceeded to investigate. And that's really how we have to look at this statute, because we believe the reason the legislature promulgated it the way it did was because a lot of times local or state prosecutors who work in county offices are overtaxed with their resources.
And is she asking that the fees be paid out of the wrongdoer's share of the estate, or?
No, the wrongdoer was not a beneficiary. The wrongdoer was a daughter of a sister of the decedent. So she was an interested person, I suppose, down the line, but she wasn't an actual beneficiary. So the answer to that is no, there was not an offset.
Okay.
As you look at the statute, once somebody believes that there could be a wrong under the statute, they have the ability to start investigating it. and that could be pre-suit investigation, that could be post-suit investigation. It's important to note that we believe the reason the legislature drafted it in this manner and gave this, we can see a wide variety of uses. You know, I have cases whereby I represent small business owners who have embezzlement. And so they use this as part of the embezzlement process to have the money returned back. And it goes into a really healthy view of this isn't criminal, but if you look at 895.446, it allows for offset if restitution is received.
Counsel, is this...
Sorry.
Is this part of your argument that attorney's fees should be awardable under 895.446?
It's part of, yes, because under the damages provision, it includes all costs of litigation. I think you have to look at it reasonably as to why that provision is crafted the way it is.
Don't we have to first look at the language of the statute?
I believe you do.
Okay. So the statute says costs of litigation in sub 3, and there is a separate subsection that addresses attorney's fees available in a different kind of action than this one is, right? So under 895.446 sub 3, you get costs of litigation. And then in a different type of claim, there is a provision in that same statute for reasonable attorney's fees, correct?
That's true.
Okay. So why, if there is a subsection that provides specifically for attorney's fees in addition to costs of litigation, why should we assume that the term costs of litigation encompasses attorney's fees as well?
It's a good question. The statute itself was not drafted contemporaneously with that provision. So you have to look at when it was drafted. The respondents purport that because there were redrafts, it's changed. And the Court of Appeals touched on that as well. And that's true. The statute was changed. But it did not make a metamorphosis to disallow attorney's fees. I would make the exact counter argument. If you look at the provision, which is sub 3M, where there is the provision of attorney's fees, that deals with, there's a lot of language in there about the word plant. And if you look at that provision, it deals with agricultural planting and fertilizer and seeds. And then subsequently, there's this language that was put in for attorney's fees, which cross-references section 943 as well. Now, the add-on of that language to the statute, we do not argue, makes the provision in sub 3 any different, doesn't give it any less weight. In fact, quite to the contrary, we think it gives it more weight. We're aware that there are fee-shifting statutes. Chapter 135, the Fair Dealership Law, provides that. There's different areas of the law that provide fee-shifting, but look at how the language is written, and it says all cost of litigation. I think we can commonly state that when you have litigation, you would have attorney's fees. And in addition to that, the legislature went even broader. It said, if you look at sub 3, it's sub 3B specifically. It states all cost of investigation. So again, it's tandem to like a law enforcement resource where law enforcement has detectives and officers and experts. Many of these cases need that. I've had cases where we need forensic experts to hire.
Counsel, did subsection 3M get added to the statute before or after subsection 3?
The answer to that question is, as I recall, the best of my recollection, it was after. However, when that occurred, or at least after the Stathis case, there was additional language that included in subsection 3B, and that language included time spent by an employee or agent. And we believe that was because in a lot of embezzlement cases, you need employees to assist the attorney who's prosecuting it civilly because they're so intensive with facts and paperwork and data that could occur in a small business setting or, for that matter, in a large business setting.
So is it your position that before the addition of 3M, that sub 3 already provided for reasonable attorney's fees?
We do. I think...
All right,
I think
so let me just stop you there then. Then why, when 3M was added, Did the legislature believe it was necessary to specifically call out reasonable attorney's fees if that was already allowed under sub 3 as cost of litigation?
Because I believe that when they drafted that piece of legislation and it reverted back to 943 and dealt back to the agricultural provisions that they were dealing with, it was just a different way in which they drafted it. They wanted to make certain that they had that covered. It's duplicative. It might be superfluous, but it certainly is not extracting of the language in sub 3.
Is there any, are there any of our cases, either here or at the Court of Appeals, that have construed cost of litigation under sub 3 to include attorney's fees besides status?
None that I'm aware of, but I would argue with that. When the Court of Appeals case came down there and it was issued, there we received a myriad of communications from practitioners in this area who were astounded that the Court of Appeals took that position, because that is how practically it's been done and how the statute's been used. STATHIS, I think, stands for the proposition it was just reasonably concluded that attorney's fees were awarded. It really was never an issue. I think the reason that STATHIS is the only case you'll find is because it was such a well-accepted fact that on these types of cases, the attorney's fees were awarded.
Are there any other statutory sections that provide for the award of costs that have been construed to include attorney's fees as well?
I'm not aware of any. I will say this. In looking at this particular provision of the statute with all costs, I've compared it with other attorney's fees provisions throughout the statutes that I'm aware of on cases that I've personally worked upon and how these are extrapolated. And I would start at the baseline. While the American rule of law is generally that each side pays its own attorney's fees, and while the general rule is that statutorily we receive our court costs, circuit courts do have discretion. And I wouldn't call it unlimited discretion, but I think it would be discretion to award costs and attorney's fees, whether it be on a motion, whether it be for sanctioning a party, or whether it would be on at the end of the verdict because of special circumstances. While those could be an abuse of discretion and they could be reviewable on appeal, in cases such as these, the legislature gave circuit courts not only the authority but essentially required them to award them, so that private attorney generals would have an incentive to take care of these types of wrongdoings. And so therefore, I use the fair dealership law as an example. There's other instances. I'm working on a timber theft case right now. Those also allow for attorney's fees.
They specifically call out attorney's fees as being awardable, correct?
In that particular case? Mm-hmm. Yes, but along with a slew of other damages. Correct. I would argue, though, Your Honor, that what this particular statute does is it doesn't narrow the attorney's fees by not including them. It actually broadens it by saying all costs associated with litigation. And when you take all costs associated with litigation, I mean, you have to think about a party who contacts an attorney to bring this case civilly. This isn't a prosecutor where they make a criminal complaint. It's a civil attorney. It's a paid attorney. It's not a public defender. And they're purporting that there was some wrong. And it's the attorney's responsibility to determine whether the cause of action is delineated in this statutory framework, whether it is an action under 895.446. And if it is, then in that instance, there's certain things he or she must prove.
Right. So, I mean, I think you make a good argument that it perhaps is good policy to allow for attorney's fees in circumstances like this. But we've got to figure out how the statutory language works first. So if we were to agree with you that costs includes attorney's fees in this section, what's the limiting principle that would allow us to say that in all of the other statutes that provide for costs, that it doesn't include attorney's fees?
I think the limiting is the cost of investigation. That's one part. And the other is all costs of litigation. I think that if you have a statute which allows for a cost of litigation, if the legislature put that in, if it used those words, I think it's reasonable to assume, and I don't even think it's an assumption, I think it's clearly what the legislature intended, that that includes the cost of the attorney who's prosecuting the case. That language isn't found. I'm not aware of it appearing anywhere else in the statutes. So if it does appear elsewhere in the statutes, I'm just not aware of it.
Did you run a computer check on that?
I checked it, but we didn't find any.
Okay. That was going to be my question, whether or not cost of litigation, that phrase we have in the statute that we are reviewing today, we have cost of investigation and cost of litigation. These are terms that have meaning, and we have to discern what the cost of litigation phrase means. I'm familiar, as are most trial judges, with Chapter 814, which is the chapter that deals with costs. But I didn't find any wording regarding cost of litigation. We have all sorts of disbursements of costs, whether it be for witness fees or copies or documents or per diem fees of the sheriff and other kinds of costs, but I don't find that phrase any place that I have looked, but I haven't looked exhaustively. But you also are not able to find that cost of litigation in any place. Okay.
I have not. I think when you look at the framework of the statute, for instance, 895.446 includes the standard, the burden that that the plaintiff must prove. If you look at the language of the statute, the legislature went so far as to state what that burden must be. So it's uniquely crafted, but I think it's uniquely crafted for a specific purpose, and that is to address these wrongdoings. These are instances where the plaintiff is alleging that somebody intentionally did something wrong, and that they took something, or that they did something that was like a crime or criminal. And so, therefore, that's what has to be proven. That's what has to be asserted, and that's the remedy for a private party in bringing it, is that
and
they get
that, that counsel seems to be... Now, Judge Falstead, who a couple decades ago was my boss, when I was a young assistant district attorney and had hair and was a little thinner, but I happen to know, as to most of the members of the bench, she's a very experienced litigator, and now she's become a very experienced judge. Now, she found adequate notice that the plaintiffs, your clients, were pursuing this under the statute that you are now referring to, the private attorney general statute. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that was based on the request for the jury instruction that would have put the opposing party on notice that this is what the claim was coming under.
That's correct. And if I can just elaborate a minute on that.
Yes.
I find that a lot of times lawyers review statutes who don't try cases, and I don't mean that badly.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
I find that a lot of times I deal with attorneys who interpret statutes, who work with statutes, but do not practically try cases. And at the final pretrial, and every circuit court judge runs their courtroom a little bit different, but at the final pretrial, it's been my experience, if you have a jury trial, that the courts will give you a pretrial order, as was here, and they'll ask for things such as instructions to the jury, verdicts, motions in limine, anything else you want to address. Sometimes those are held in chambers and then brought out to put on the record. Some judges hold them in courtroom. I had a judge in Sheboygan County one time that had a dry erase board in his chambers, and we spent 3 hours working through the issues that he thought was important for trial. But I think it's important to note that's not run by the lawyers. The lawyers don't go to the final pretrial and tell the judge what's going to be done. The judge tells the lawyers.
Having been a circuit court judge for 6 years and sharing the bench with former circuit court judges who were judges for longer than 6 years, we agree.
So when
I affirm. No dissent.
So when that happens, each side is given an equal opportunity to persuade the circuit court judge on how they believe the verdict should read and what instruction should go to the jury. And it is the circuit court judge that makes that determination. In this particular case, that is done, and it was done, and Diane Story's attorney agreed with them. He acquiesced to what was there, and in fact, if you read the record, the circuit court judge, I believe, did an exhaustive request to him that was he sure that this is how they wanted to proceed, and he agreed. So I don't think that it's fair to say that the defendant in this particular case was bushwhacked with lack of knowledge that this is what was coming. The statute is laid out pretty clearly, and it was discussed. So I just think that that framework of how the final pretrial works, I once read a book called The Art of the Trial. Well, that's where you set the table for the trial, and that's what we're talking about.
Well, I have a I'm sorry. Are you done?
Just one quick thank you. And the customary practice for a trial court judge at the conclusion of going through all of the proposed jury instructions is to ask both counsel if they have any requests for additions, redactions, or changes of any kind. I don't recall reading the transcript of that here, but I would bet that Judge Falstead did that here. And if she did, what was the response?
Yeah, it was the same. In fact, what happened here was the judge's judicial assistant took what we had and typed them into her format, how she wanted it. They were circulated to the attorneys the morning of trial, and they were discussed on breaks between trial. And there was, and if the defendant objected to them, he or they would be allowed to then go back on the record and state their objections to preserve the record. And there was no objection whatsoever.
Thank you.
Small claims actions are somewhat unique in and of themselves, largely guided by Chapter 799. 799.25 is entitled Costs, and sub 10 of 799.25 is Attorney's Fees. What, if any, import do you think that has on your argument that attorney's fees are considered costs in a small claims judgment?
I don't think that has any bearing, and here's why. I had a small claims trial once where I was awarded attorney's fees because the court declared the opposing party's case to be frivolous. And I think when you look at 799, the monetary limitation is the $10,000. The other damages, such as attorney's fees, taxable court costs, exemplary damages, those are in addition to the amount in controversy, which is the $10,000. I really don't think there's any issue with that here. I think the statutory framework is pretty consistent, and I also believe that I would make two arguments, or two points of delineation on that. First, I think that the trial court is pretty aware of how they're going to address those, or if they issue spot. And I think number two, when you're looking at these damages, and while it's a civil procedure, it's a little bit of a civil procedure issue. Sometimes when it's fast and furious in the course of trial, civil procedure changes or there's notifications that get put into the record. And while that's not the ideal way of proceeding through a trial, I've done enough of this to know that sometimes that happens, and it's just the way it is. And the Wisconsin's a notice pleading state, and we have the ability to do that, again, with the approval of the circuit court. It's not the attorneys that govern that. So here, while I think that has been an issue raised at appeal, I really don't think it's an issue that's all that paramount, because I think the remedy of that would be, in my experience, a circuit court judge would just say, we're moving this up to civil. You have to pay, really the only ramifications.
Yeah, you got to pay a different fee. You filed it by paying a reduced fee, so I don't know how the circuit court can change it to a large claim action.
I've had it happen.
Well, I don't, what you've had happen is interesting, But we have to kind of deal with the statutes, and the statutes put a limit on it, and they put an amount commensurate with the limit that is charged at the circuit court when the matter commences. So I don't see how the circuit court can now say this is a large claim case when those are not the fees that have been paid.
But I don't think there's any limitation in the statutes as to when that's done, is my point. I think the statute says that pleadings can be amended subject to the approval of the circuit court. So the point I would make is that, hypothetically, it didn't happen here, but if you're in the middle of a trial and some issue came up where it needed to get moved to large claims, I think the ramification is, unless there's objection, they could do that and just pay the fee. And
was that changed here, and did you pay an increased fee?
It never came up.
Okay. Are still in small claims then, if it never came up?
Right, because the amount in controversy didn't exceed the $10,000.
Are you saying the trial court judge awarded fees based upon the statute or based upon its discretion and some sort of sanction?
I think both. I think under the statute, the circuit court awarded the fees, and if you review the record, you'll note that we asked for more fees than were awarded. And she exercised her discretion as to what she thought was the appropriate fee and what fee was just under the law.
Well, I mean, typically you pay your own fees, so I'm trying to figure out what your argument is. Are you arguing that these fees are part of costs under the statute and that's what the court hung its hat on? Or are you arguing that the court said, this is so egregious and this is, you know, I'm sanctioning you for this, and as a result of the sanction, I am awarding attorney's fees? There's different ways trial judges deal with this. And frankly, I'm sort of surprised that you didn't bite on what I gave you as far as the cost statute that outlines fees are costs. But since you don't want to touch that, tell me what it is the court did here, because those are two different ways to get fees. Which one is it? Or is it both?
Well, I
am finding that these fees are costs under the statute and awarding them based on this, or did the court say, I am finding that I am sanctioning your behavior and I see your light is on, maybe you can just quick answer and then
The answer to that question is, in this particular case, given the facts at hand and how it was tried, it was under 895.446 sub 3. That is what we brought to the court, and so that was the instance. But my point would be, I don't believe that the statutes would limit the circuit court, after sitting through this entire trial, making the determination that it did. So,
no, but then we'd have to remand, right? Because there are no findings to support a sanction, are there?
I would say that you could remand, but given the fact that the circuit court sat through the entire trial, the ability to build that record on findings would be what was known to the court and the record itself.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It may please the court, my name is Jennifer Slater Carlson. I'm representing Diane Story in this matter.
Ma'am, would you be kind enough to pull that microphone a little closer to you? Thank you.
Yes, I'll try to lean forward as well.
Thanks.
It's a large podium. Interestingly enough, I noticed counsel for the estate said that this was a textbook case. I find this to be a textbook case of statutory construction, is what it is. When I was first asked to take this matter up on appeal, and for the court's information, if the court's not aware, I was not the trial attorney in this case. I took this case on for purposes of the appeal. The first thing I did was I read the transcripts, and then I read the statutes. And it immediately caught my eye that 895.446 sub 3 sub B, under which this case was brought, does not mention attorney's fees. But we had a subsequent statute that, or a subsection of the statute, being 3MB, as you've noted, that did specifically mention attorney's fees.
Counsel?
Yes.
I apologize. Would you mind if I detoured you a little bit?
Yes.
There are a couple of other issues in this case we haven't had a chance to talk with Mr. Swid about, but I want to get to.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about the cap on the damages in a small claims case.
Yes.
My understanding is the contest here between the two of you is whether this claim under 895.446 counts as a tort as opposed to an other civil action. And the significance being that if it's an other civil action, there's a $10,000 cap versus a $5,000, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Something Mr. Swid said, and I'll ask him about this when he stands back up, suggested to me that he might be taking the position that the damage caps come off when this goes to circuit court for a trial de novo in front of a jury. Do you have any position on that?
I do. I do not believe that that's the case. We are still in small claims court. This case was always in small claims court. And 799.01 specifically limits the damages for any action based in tort to $5,000.
Okay. So now let's get to the difference between tort and other civil action.
Yes.
Tell me what the difference is.
Sure. A tort, by definition, is a wrongful act in which harm or injury is caused by another. That's the definition of a tort.
Okay. So how would that be different from what would an other civil action be that is not a tort?
I actually thought about that question before I came here today, wondering an other similar action could be perhaps something that would be based in contract but still have some tort underlyings. It could be anything that I guess that wasn't related or quote-unquote, as the statute says, based in tort. So, for example, if we look to the jury instructions that came along with this cause of action, the Wisconsin Civil and Jury Instruction, I believe it's 2419, is under the category of misrepresentation. Misrepresentation, as we've learned in law school, is a tort type of action. And if you look further at that section of the Wisconsin Civil Jury Instructions, all of the subsections fall under the main section of an intentional tort. So I think in the law, this kind of conduct and under this kind of statute are all based in tort.
I think there is some merit to your suggestion there. But we've got to flesh out what an other civil action would be so that we can distinguish that from torts, right? Because when we look at 799.01, we look at you're invoking CR, subsection CR.
Yes.
And you're saying, well, this is a tort, and so there's a $5,000 cap. Subsection D says for other civil actions, it's 10. So we need to know what an other civil action would be and then determine how to distinguish that from a tort. Mm-hmm. So what would the principle be to distinguish between those?
Another civil action could be some type of a consumer issue, perhaps, that was based more on of a duty, let's say, of a manufacturer, which I know can also be an intentional tort, a product liability type of a thing. Another civil action could perhaps pend from a divorce somehow, perhaps if one party owes another party money. All-encompassing, and it appears to be sort of that catch-all for the small claims jurisdiction. So the jurisdictional statute on the amounts covers very specific things, and then it appears to have this other civil action as a catch-all for everything else that those specific things don't meet.
Right. So, but it has to have some discernible meaning so that we can distinguish between whether we're under CR or D. So how about a statutorily created cause of action? Could that be an other civil action?
Well, that would depend. Mm-hmm. It could be an other civil action if it weren't somehow covered under the other types of actions specifically enumerated within the statute.
So in this case, we're dealing with 895.446, and that says, according to its own terms, that it has created a cause of action. And the cause of action is a civil remedy for a criminal statute, right?
Yes.
Okay. So criminal statutes are not torts.
Right? Correct.
Okay. So why would it be, would it do any violence to the statutory language to conclude that a statute that creates a civil remedy for a criminal action, to call that an other civil action?
I wouldn't, because by creating that civil action, similarly, as I mentioned in my brief to like a federal 1983 type of action, it is creating a civil action, and civil actions aren't criminal. Civil actions are things like torts.
Well,
counsel tort
can be a criminal action, and clearly a battery is a crime. But a battery is also a civil tort.
Yes.
Intentional civil tort.
And so once it's brought into the civil arena, it becomes a tort.
Exactly.
Correct.
So there's an overlap between a criminal statute and a tort.
I would agree.
There can be.
Murder, yes, I would agree.
For example, too, can be wrongful death and a tort.
Correct. Once brought into the civil arena, we then have to categorize it within our laws, within the civil courts.
I don't know why this is such a so complicated. I look at the kind of cases that this court gets periodically under 100.18, and that is cases that involve misrepresentation. Your premise is this involves misrepresentation, and misrepresentation is a tort. And yet we have had several cases, and I'm sure the Court of Appeals has had many more, under 100.18, which deals with, in part, unfair trade practices and fraudulent misrepresentations, false, deceptive, misleading, and otherwise fraudulent representations is the description. It is misleading, a misrepresentation, and that's considered a statutory civil claim. So, you know, that's one that we are a bit more familiar with as a court in terms of having cases that have dealt with this area of law. So why is the case under 895.446, which is kind of a civilian attorney general act, you know, a civilian mm-hmm. prosecutor act, just like 100.18 is. It says you can do your private attorney general or the attorney general can bring the lawsuit under 100.18. Why isn't this the same thing? And we have a plethora of cases on under 100.18.
And I'm not intimately familiar with 100.18. However, I believe I can touch on your question. I think it's different in one way in that it's not a prosecutor wouldn't be bringing a case under 895.446. If a prosecutor thought Ms. Story should have been prosecuted, he would have brought that as a criminal action under, I believe it was 943.20.
Yes, but a prosecutor can bring a claim under 943.20, and that does not eliminate the potential for a private individual to bring under 895.446, does it?
No, it would not. So both of those actions could have taken place. But I think what it goes to is the fact that we're in small claims court. The estate chose to file this cause of action. It was based in tort, based on supposedly her misappropriation of funds from her uncle's estate. And they chose to bring it in small claims court where there are these jurisdictional limitations on damages. Had the action been brought in large claims court, this would not have been an issue.
But I understand they're not asking for damages in excess of $10,000, which is the jurisdictional limit of small claims court. Now, we have the issue of whether or not it should be $5,000, whether this is a tort rather than a statutory misrepresentation claim, whether it's a torturous misrepresentation claim, and sometimes things seem kind of torturous when they're torturous.
Well, and I believe that a statutory claim can still be based in tort. And if you look at the language of 79901CR, it says that the jurisdictional limitation is $5,000 for claims based in tort. And even though it's a statute, it's still based in this tort of misappropriation.
Well, see, that's kind of circular to me. That goes back to my greater familiarity with 100.18, which is a statutory claim of private attorney general. It's not considered, I don't think, in our jurisprudence to be a tort action. It's a statutory action.
Well, you know, and as I was doing the research on this, and looking at it, there weren't cases that specifically classified this is a tort, this is some other kind of action. But what I did find in my research was cases that specifically referenced the underlying action, and they referenced it as a tort. The two cases specifically that I came across were the H.A. Friend case, and that was an economic loss doctrine case where the court found that the economic loss doctrine didn't apply despite the fact that the underlying action was a tort. And it was in the same statute as we have in this case. The Shopko case, which was a case that was cited for punitive damages primarily in our briefs, also references, and it was a very similar statute, that was commercial theft. However, if you look at the language, it's very similar. And the court, again, specifically referred to the underlying conduct as being the underlying tort action.
Also,
that those weren't small claims court cases, so they didn't have the same issue here.
I'd find it a lot easier to find your argument intuitive if there had not been the acquiescence during the jury instruction phase of the trial to move it to the statutory claim under the 895-446. And there the circuit court gave both parties the opportunity for input on the jury instructions, and the circuit court found that both parties received notice that the claim was being pursued under that statute. And so I noted well your opposing counsel, his colloquy between the Chief Justice, where she asked, well, did you pay the higher court costs? No, it never came up. And generally, no, it doesn't come up at the jury instruction conference phase of the trial, but still the point was made. But still the larger point is made. The circuit court made it her finding that your client received fair notice that the plaintiff was pursuing a claim under the private attorney general statute. And so when I look at the statute, it is not just in isolation that I read it, that is the mirror image of the misrepresentation, but it brings with it a host of other things that flow from it, which form the basis of why we're here. So how can we accept, what is the logical distinction we can make if we accept your argument to say, well, look, it's the same cause of action, but stop your reading there at subsection 2, but don't go on to read 3, 3M, and at SEC where it talks about the other costs and awards that can be made. And I understand your fallback so far in response to the questions from all my colleagues has been, we're in small claims court. I hear you. You were in small claims court until the judge. It seems to me the argument anyway is you were in small claims court until that jury instruction conference where the court made it clear, look, this is now being pursued under Section 895.446. How is it we can make a logical distinction between the guts of the claim, misrepresentation, and the remedies that flow? How should we cut that off where you want us to cut it off?
Well, I don't think you need to cut it off. And if I'm understanding your question correctly, yes, Judge Falstead did say, I believe all the parties had notice and that this claim has been tried as a claim under 895.446. And we accept that. Our position is that a claim under 895.446 is a statutory tort. It is a claim based in tort. And as a result, the damages permitted for actual damages are subject to the jurisdictional limitation. Now, we didn't brief the next thing that I'm going to say. I've done some research on it, but it wasn't brief because it never really came up. I do believe there are cases out there that talk about how in small claims court, things like additional awards of statutory attorney's fees or exemplary damages can be above and beyond the small claims court limit. I don't know if that's getting to your question. What I'm talking about, the $5,000 limitation, goes to the actual damages. And it's up to the plaintiff, the estate in this case, to determine when they're filing their case, okay, I've got an action that's based in tort. Even if it's a statute that's based in a tort, the legislature has gone in and codified this. And we've had some discussion here today about how, you know, the legislature has, I'm going to use the word codified, essentially, this tort of misappropriation or of these funds. And as a result, the legislature made some determinations that in addition to the actual damages that would normally be permitted under common law, we're also going to allow certain other things from a policy standpoint. And that's where 3B comes into, or the remainder, I guess it would be 3B and C,
right,
come into play. Under the common law misappropriation of funds, which actually was all that was pled in the,
right,
small claims complaint.
Yes.
You couldn't have gone, you know, the common law would only permit sub A. But once you get into the statute, I do understand that above and beyond that $5,000 jurisdictional limit for actual damages, the case law does permit other types of awards, which is where sub B and C would come in.
If I understand you correctly, then, you acknowledge that 895.446 claim was made, but your assertion is it was made within a Chapter 799 proceeding as a claim whose damages were, for actual damages, were limited by Chapter 799.
I would say yes with one caveat. Okay. It was initially an issue as to whether or not there was notice. The Court of Appeals agreed with the,
right,
trial court, and we did not take that any further.
Right. So before us, the issue is as I've explained it.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, the concept of what is the nature of a statutory action is not really new. And it comes up as to whether or not your party is entitled to a jury trial. So if you have a statute that gives a cause of action, one of the parties may seek a jury trial. And the issue then is the statute comparable to something at common law for which you're entitled to a jury trial, right? Isn't that the law?
It is.
Right.
And that would be exactly what happened here, that it would be based in tort. That's that common law.
That's your argument. So the concept that you look at a statute to see if it is comparable to a common law tort is the one you're asking to be applied here.
Yes.
And there's a rule in 799, you can ask for a jury trial, and I don't know that that's limited to common law, or that you get it right to a jury trial in 799 anyway. And I don't know that it matters.
I would have to relook at that statute on that specific point.
Yeah, I did, and I'm not
okay.
Sure. The other thing about it is that you started in 799, and there was a ruling, but you're entitled to a de novo trial, right?
Yes.
And that's what happened here.
Yes.
But even at the de novo trial, you're still under 799.
Absolutely.
And then 799 says when you have a de novo trial in 799, you still apply the 807 to whatever the last provision is about regular trials. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So you're taking the position, though, that you still have to look to see whether this is a tort, and you're still bound by the $5,000, even though you now have a de novo trial in Chapter 799.
Yes. Once you go before the court commissioner and you get a ruling, and interestingly enough, in this case, the court commissioner had ruled in favor of Ms. Story.
Right.
But then the estate appealed that and got their de novo trial
and
requested a jury.
Right.
But that doesn't take you out of 799 just
right.
Because they've requested a de novo jury trial. We're still under the jurisdictional requirements of small claims court.
And this case has a number of issues. One, whether there's been a forfeiture of exemplary damages. Two, whether attorney fees are part of the cost. Three, whether you're limited to $5,000 because it's a tort. And four, on reconsideration. And I found it interesting that the estate here, of all the issues, starts with and emphasizes the attorney fees. Why? You don't. You start with and emphasize that you're limited to $5,000 award here. And that's what you've been discussing, because it's taught. So what about these other issues?
Oh.
And why do you think the emphasis is on attorney fees? Do they get attorney fees even if they lose on the $5,000?
So why do I think
the estate put the emphasis on the...
Well, I think the estate perhaps put the emphasis on the attorney's fees because it's very important to them that they collect their attorney's fees.
shucks. And they think they have a good chance of doing that. Otherwise, you would go to something else.
Well, I think that, interestingly enough, on the attorney's fee issue, it may very well be that as a matter of practice in some circuit courts. Under this statute, courts have been allowing and attorneys have been seeking attorney's fees. However, just because that's been our practice, if it's wrong, it doesn't mean we should keep it up. This court did an excellent job in laying out our rules of statutory construction in the Kalal case. And following Kalal, and some of the quotes there on statutory construction, I don't see how we can award attorney's fees under sub 3B, given the subsequent existence of sub 3M, and some of the statutory construction in particular that, for example, quoting the U.S. Supreme Court, this court said, we have stated time and time again that courts must presume that the legislature in a statute says what it means and means in a statute what it says there.
Yes. Can I talk to you a little bit, moving you out of small claims a little bit and into probate court?
Okay.
It's a trickier issue when, as sitting as a probate judge, you have a pending case of some sort where the money is supposed to be coming from that pending case into probate, right?
Yes.
It could be anything, personal injury case, wrongful death case. It could be anything where money is coming in. When you sit as the personal representative, your duty is to make sure you get it all, you get it right, and you inventory it so that people know what they have coming, right?
Okay.
Makes sense so far, right? If I, as a personal representative, don't pursue a conversion or something that's brought to my attention, a beneficiary of the estate can challenge my inventory, bring that cause of action, and get attorney's fees paid to them for bringing that action, I think. How does the role of a personal representative and the way an estate works and the duties and responsibilities of the personal representative work with your argument?
Well, I don't practice in probate court, as a matter of course.
Right, but
so
it's a little different
your,
animal.
As to be true, I think in this particular situation, the personal representative needed to weigh the pros and the cons of what she believed happened and to make her own educated decision on how to handle that. And I would say that representatives of estates need to do that all the time.
Right. And they need to
weigh those pros and cons and make those choices. And her choice in this situation, based on her own, investigation, was to pursue this.
She gets paid from her client.
Why isn't this a necessary and reasonable fee as the cost of acting as a personal representative?
Under the probate law?
Right.
Well,
it wasn't raised.
I guess I would need to research that to really be able to properly respond.
Okay. Fair enough.
It was never raised as that. This was not raised as fees or costs to cover the personal representative's time. This was raised as an issue under 895.446 sub 3B as to compensate attorney's fees for Mr. Swift. And when the court did that, there was conversation about how much time he had put in and how he was aware that the court would realize how much time Mr. Swid had put in bringing this case. And that's different than any time that the personal representative might have also put in to the case. The court, interestingly enough, awarded that $20,000 in attorney's fees based on Mr. Swid's time. There was not evidence put into the record, such as a an hourly rate, but it was the conversation that they had really had more to do with the time than the contingent fee agreement that Mr. Swid has with the estate.
Counsel,
and that was one of my other points.
If you've answered Justice Ziegler's question, Justice Ziegler, if I might.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to this cap issue and see if we can come at it a little bit different direction. I'm looking at the small claims complaint, and it has the box checked next to claim for money, $10,000 or less, and it also has the box checked under plaintiff's demand, claim for money, $10,000. So presumably Ms. Story took note of that when the complaint was filed and served, yes? We can assume that to be true?
Yes.
All right. Was there, under plaintiff's demand, there is a line with a box next to it for tort / personal injury that could have been checked, right, if that's the way that the complaint had been set up, but that was not checked in this case. What did Ms. Story ever object to the characterization of this complaint as other civil action as opposed to tort?
My red light is on. Can I go ahead and answer your question?
Yes, please do.
Okay. Ms. Story's counsel objected at the time of post-verdict motions, as I believe the first time that objection was made. The jury brought back an award of $10,000 in actual damages. And at that time, that objection was made.
So the case was tried under the assumption, everybody assumed, that this was a case for seeking damages of $10,000 or less. Why should we not find that Ms. Story waived this issue by not raising an objection prior to trial?
Well, because what I can tell you is that while that box was checked, that doesn't necessarily mean that that box was accurately checked. And as you can see from, you're aware that from the briefing, there was also an offer of settlement before trial in the amount of $7,500. Ms. Story's counsel actually rejected that offer in his own way of thinking that this was a $5,000 jurisdictional limitation because this was an action based in tort.
But did he ever say that to opposing counsel? Did he ever say that to court prior
to
the case
being tried?
Okay. So why should we not find that that is a waiver of that issue?
I think it shouldn't be a waiver because the statute 799.01 is a jurisdictional limitation. And I think it's appropriate if a jury brings back an award over anything over the jurisdictional limited amount by statute, it is then the responsibility of the court to reduce that down. We see that, for example, in wrongful death claims, medical malpractice claims. We don't tell a jury, oh, and you can only give this amount of money. The jury is sent back to answer the question, and then the court reduces that within the jurisdictional limitations. And because it is a jurisdictional limitation, I don't believe it can be waived. We're in small claims court.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Seeing as this court requires the attorneys to speak with candor, I must say this discussion about attorneys' fees is something that's near and dear to private practitioners' hearts. But this is not a case of first impression. I think the state this case...
Counsel, let's leave off the attorneys' fees for just a moment, understanding how near and dear they are to your heart. And having been in that position relatively recently myself, I fully concur with that sentiment. However, let's talk about what is tort. How do we distinguish between a tort and an other civil action, and why would you say this falls into an other civil action?
I think this would be an other civil action, and I say that because we cited the Kalin, K-A-I-L-I-N, the Armstrong case, and that was a case that was a court of appeals case, and as Justice Bradley was kind of alluding to with 100.18, and we deal with the economic loss doctrine. In that case, in paragraph 40, the court held or made a distinction that statutory claims are not meant to add on other claims. They're not meant to be other misrepresentation claims or the like. So here, what I would argue is when we think of tort, when we advance tort claims, they're not rooted in statute as they are here. This is a statutory claim that it would be different than your standard tort claim, which is in common law.
So your opposing counsel says this is just codification of misappropriation of funds. Is 943.20 different from the tort of misappropriation of funds?
I do, yes.
What's the difference?
The statute is specifically crafted to be different than just the common law doctrines. It's specifically crafted to give people a mechanism to do something more than common law tort. That is the tool in the toolbox for those people that are aggrieved.
So is it your position that 895.446 is a private attorney general statute, and that what you are doing is enforcing the terms of 943.20 as opposed to a tort?
I think it's a. The answer to that question is I think it's a little bit bifurcated in as much as it is not a common law tort claim, and I don't think that we can call a tort and then say, well, this is also a tort even though it's not a tort. What I mean by that is common law torts are what the legislature intended when in 799 it wrote that torts are limited to $5,000, and there's reasons for that. There's reasons the legislature did that. They didn't do it here. And therefore, under 799, it falls under the other actions because it's a statutory claim, a specific statutory claim.
Counselor, I think the statute says based in tort. If they just wanted to say no common law torts, why don't they say that? I think you acknowledge that we do have statutes that are grounded in tort actions. You know, as we learned in law school, a tort is a civil wrong, right? You did a wrong to someone else. We always contrasted them with contracts where the parties agreed what they were going to do in regard to a particular issue. The damages were often different because tort damages tend to be spread and contract damages tend to be specific. So I guess I'm not quite understanding why you think that because there's a statutory claim here, it isn't based in tort.
Because I don't believe that's what the legislature intended under 799 to limit.
What did they say under 799 that causes you to believe that?
Well, I think that when you look at the framework of the word tort, I would give you an analogous argument.
Okay.
You know, the legislature uses the word court. It doesn't say judge and it doesn't say jury. It says court. It would be nice if it said this is a question for a judge, this is a question for a jury, but they don't do that. It's the same thing here. The purpose of 799 as it relates to tort, you have to look at the framework of the chapter. What is 799 for? It's to get prompt resolution of small claims, in many cases for pro se litigants. And in this case, that was a little bit different. And while we will be under the auspices of those rules, the reason torts is specifically used is because those tend to run into some more complicated issues that probably fall outside the parameters of a standard small claims case, which would be medical opinions, depositions, and the like. We have to look, you can't look at this in a vacuum to say, well, they just meant to kick out these claims and limit them to $5,000. There's a method to the madness on how they drafted this, but in this particular case, looking at it in light of the Kalin case, which is our standing precedent on it, it doesn't create an additional tort claim. It's rooted in that statute. So I think it's a little bit parsing words on that. If you just say, well, it's a tort and it's limited only to the $5,000, I think on the flip side of that, the legislature could have said, for instance, these claims under the statute can't be tried in small claims. They can only be tried in civil court. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. On behalf of my co-counsel, Benjamin Krokramer, thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you both for very good arguments and very good briefs. It's quite an interesting number of questions that you've given us today. We're going to take a brief recess now so that folks can come and go for the next case, and we are ready.